Hi, folks. This is Brad Watson, pastor at Nexus Church. We are glad you have found our sermon podcast and that you're interested in our teachings. If you've ever considered financially supporting our work at Nexus Church, you can do that at nexuschurch.ca/give. Thanks for listening and thanks for your support.
Post-Easter, and now we are back into the tensions. And we've talked over the course of this year about our tensions with God, tension with ourselves, tensions with our faith, traditions, but we're going to go deeper into our tensions with other people, relational tensions. And many years ago, I did a sermon entitled Sex on a Ladder. And so what I want to do is I want to take that one teaching and I want to put it into a series. We're going to put everything on a ladder. Friendship, marriage, sex, community, everything relational, we're going to stick on a ladder. I might bring a ladder next week, but for this morning, what I want to do is take us on a bit of an odyssey adventure into a brief history of marriage. Marriage, what is this institution? Where did it come from? What does it mean to be married? Well, consider this. I find this fascinating. Anthropologists have studied and been aware of at least 4,000 distinct cultures in history. They discovered in the course of history more than 7,000 distinct languages and societies. At bare minimum, the world in its history has seen 7,000 different societies. And of those 7,000, anthropologists know of only one society in the history of the world that did not make marriage a central way of organizing people. That group is the Na people of China. They're a farming people in the Himalayan region, and they're the only, according to anthropologists, the only society in the world that does not have marriage. What they have instead is siblings. Siblings are the corner of their society. And so it doesn't matter who the father of a child is. Siblings stay together and raise children. It's the only society in all of history we know of that didn't organize around marriage. And beyond that one group of people then, anthropologists have discovered that every other culture has had some form of marriage that has served as sort of the central way, you could say, of organizing life, social, sexual, and personal lives. That, to me, is about as close as you get to a human universal. Marriage, human universal, pretty close. And in studying the way humans do marriage, one of the things that anthropologists have found is that it's so diverse. So diverse. And the thing is, we are today very well aware of how we organize our own version of marriage, but marriage has some constants, but also a ton of variation. And so what I would start with this morning is busting 8 myths around marriage. And I actually took one out, so there's only going to be 7, but see if you notice where I switch numbers here. But myth number one about marriage in world history. Marriage has always been about 2 people loving one another. Incorrect. Rarely in the history of the world has marriage been seen about marrying for love. A common saying in early modern Europe was this: the one who marries for love has good nights and bad days. I think that's kind of funny. Stephanie Kuntz, in her landmark book, Marriage, A History, this book is fantastic. She said, certainly people fell in love, sometimes even with their own spouses. But marriage was not fundamentally about love. It was too vital an economic and political institution to be entered into solely on the basis of something as irrational as love. Myth two, when I think, oh, marriage, men have been the breadwinners all throughout history. Another incorrect assumption. For thousands of years, women and children were a huge part of what it meant to be the breadwinner, so to speak. In fact, in hunter-gatherer societies, they assume, actually, that women and children brought home more of the meat, the bread, so to speak, than males going out on a hunt. And so this idea, the 1950s idea of marriage as sort of man, a sole breadwinner, other partner stays at home from work. There's a blip, you could say, in the history of marriage. Number three, marriage has always been about two people coupling. Unfortunately, no. And this is interesting to me. When you take a scan of world history, what has been the most common form of marriage throughout world history in more times and more places, it's been polygyny, where a man can have multiple wives. This is the most popular form of marriage over the history of the world, a man with several wives, and I know what we're thinking. Myth number four, women have always been against this. Not so much. In Botswana, there is a common saying, goes this way, without co-wives, a woman's work is never done. Need more than one to get all the work done, apparently. And you go, is this an isolated example? There's all these interesting, in Stephanie's book there, these interesting examples of a man actually trying to divorce one of his three, four wives, and then coming together and be like, no, I don't think so. No, we're a unit. We got the co-wives. So, All right, number five. Marriage has always been about leaving your immediate family and clinging to your spouse. In a lot of areas of the world, the marriage partner is totally secondary to family. For instance, the Kiowa tribe of Indians, they have a saying, goes this way, a woman can always get another husband, but she only has one brother. Loyalty. In China, you only have one family, but you can always get another wife. So throughout history, one way or the other, it's like, you can get another one. But your family, that's what's truly important. Marriage, number six, has always been about sexual loyalty. Nope. Sexual loyalty was not a high priority. The expectation of mutual fidelity is a rather recent invention, you could say. Numerous cultures have allowed husbands to seek sexual gratification outside of marriage. Less frequently, although enough to challenge preconceptions, wives have also been allowed to do this in various forms across the world. In a study of 109 societies, anthropologists found that only 48 forbade extramarital sex to both husbands and wives. And then, biggest myth, I've had this conversation with many people over the past couple of years. There's sort of two competing ideas out there. Marriage was invented so men could protect women, or vice versa, marriage was invented so men could exploit women. Stephanie Kuhn says, incorrect on both accounts. Marriage, she says, spoke to the needs of the larger group, converted strangers into relatives, and extended cooperative relations beyond the immediate family or small clans by creating far-flung networks of in-laws. Since the dawn of civilization, getting in-laws has been one of marriage's most important functions. Gradually, marriage exchanges became a way of consolidating resources rather than creating a circle of reciprocal obligations and connections. Where it had once been a way of expanding the number of cooperating groups, it now became a way for powerful kin groups to accumulate both people and property. Greater economic differentiation reshaped the rules of marriage. I do not believe, then, that marriage was invented to oppress women any more than it was invented to protect them. In most cases, marriage probably originated as an informal way of organizing sexual companionship, child rearing, and the daily tasks of life. It became more formal, more permanent, as groups began to exchange spouses over larger distances. Interesting, this universal worldwide institution, and all the variation we see of it across time and place is fascinating to me. And I bring up these myths because for two reasons. First, marriage is a human universal, but how humans have expressed it over the centuries and millennia has looked very different. But second, what I hope it does is it helps us appreciate that our version of marriage today is culturally conditioned as well. So how do we think about marriage today? When you ask what marriage is, it's interesting. Neither the anthropologist nor the sociologist can agree. There's just too much fluctuation. But if you had to boil it down from anthropologists, they would say this. Marriage is a universal institution where two people engage in sexual activity and cooperate economically. That's it. Two people who have sex and share finances. Notice anything really big missing in that definition, like love? Strange and a little uncomfortable, but I've come to think of it this way. Imagination exercise for you. Imagine you have an individual in front of you and you have to figure out whether they're married, but you can't ask them whether they're married. How would you figure it out? Well, you could ask, is there someone you really love in life? And they might say, yeah, my mom, my dad, sister, brother, who knows? But there's one question followed by another that will help you figure it out every time, I think. First is this. Say to someone, do you share a bank account with anyone? And if they say yes, you say, do you also happen to have sex with that person? And if they say yes, you go, I bet you're married. I bet you're married. At its most base, about as good as we can get for defining marriage in our day, marriage is sharing a bed and a bank account. Next time you go to introduce your spouse, consider this. I hate introducing Kristen as my partner or my spouse. I hate that. I just hate it. So I have a new idea. And I get we don't want to use gendered words for how we talk about our partners, but I have a new idea. Go up to someone. I've got Kristen with me. And they say, oh, who's this? I say, this is Kristen. She's my bed and banking buddy. Everyone would know. Ah, you're married. Yes. My bed and banking buddy. That's what anthropologists boil marriage down to. But here's my guess. My guess and hunch is that most of us in this room are going, I'm uncomfortable with that. It's so pragmatic. Really? Marriage is just who I share my bed and bank account with? Because the thing is, we desperately want marriage to be about more than just sex or money. We want it to be more romantic than that. Because there's something disenchanted about just saying, this is the person I have a bed and bank account with. That's like, ugh, I don't know. It lacks a certain sacredness, you could say. It lacks mystery. It lacks an enchantment. And I agree, and we're going to address that problem a little later on, but I know what you're all thinking. Thanks for the history there, Brad. Can you tell us when the church messed everything up? All right, let's get into how did the church and Christianity mess up marriage? Well, one of the most interesting things to me is that for the earliest Christians, they placed like hardly any emphasis on marriage. Jesus came along and he insisted that there were things more important than marriage and the family. There was an urgent need for people to get ready and prepared for the kingdom of God. And so we have the uncomfortable sayings of Jesus, right? Like large crowds were traveling with Jesus and turning to them, he said, if anyone comes to me and does not hate father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, even their own life, such a person cannot be my disciple. And you go, whoa. Or then this, considering how important family was in marriage, particularly in the past, another disciple said to him, Lord, let me first go and bury my father. But Jesus told him, follow me, let the dead bury their own dead. There's, in Jesus' mind, you can almost pick out a certain, like an antagonism or even a deep ambivalence about marriage and extended family. And when you start to realize, like Stephanie points out in her book, that marriage is about wealth consolidation, you start to go, oh, I kind of get what's going on here. And then you have Paul come along. He says, I would like you to be free from concern. An unmarried man is concerned about the Lord's affair, how he can please the Lord, but a married man is concerned about the affairs of this world, how he can please his wife. His interests are divided. An unmarried woman or virgin is concerned about the Lord's affair. Her aim is to be devoted to the Lord in both body and spirit, but a married woman is concerned about the affairs of this world, how she can please her husband. So first century Christianity takes off, and Paul's like, you really should be single. It's really the better way. And Jesus seems to be like, I don't know about this whole marriage family thing. It divides loyalties. And their attitudes stood in sharp contrast to prevailing opinions, because the revolutionary opinion of the earliest church was that the biological, nuclear, or extended family was not the most important thing in life. And I think this remains a rebuke to world history. I feel this still, because there's nothing that takes up more time and energy than the nuclear family, the extended family. It requires a lot. In fact, there's almost hints, I would say, in the earliest church that the extended family unit was actually a problem, because the family so easily becomes a place of excessive self-focus and wealth consolidation. Yeah, self-focus. How often am I driving my kids to this practice? Yeah, it becomes very focused on me and my family. So there's a rebuke there that I don't want to keep talking about, because I'm violating it and giving a lot of attention to my family. But that was the earliest Christians. Time went on, and part of the idea why they were so ambivalent about marriage is they thought Jesus was returning any day now, so who cares about marriage? But then, you know, you got a few centuries, and you're like, maybe Jesus isn't coming back really soon, and the church starts to gain power and influence. So what did the church do with marriage? Well, are you ready for this? What did the church do with marriage? It did nothing. Nothing. Consider this. For the first 1,200 years of the church existence, legal marriage depended solely upon the partner's intent. Catholic Church long held that if a man and woman said they had privately agreed to marry, whether they said those words in the kitchen or out by the haystack, they were in fact married. For more than 1,000 years, the church just took their word for it. Once you'd given your word, the church agreed, you couldn't take it back. Church itself showed little concern about what made for a valid marriage or divorce. The church was dealing with a population whose traditions considered mutual intent or the blessing of a parent sufficient to solemnize a marriage. It wasn't until the 16th century and not until 1753 in England that governments and churches could enforce a rule requiring specific legal and public formalities to validate a marriage. I so wish today that we would wake up and realize our own history. Because I'm entirely convinced, across denomination and church lines, one of the biggest wars churches fight today is about marriage. And I can't help but wonder if we could find a way out if we returned to the posture of the early church. You say you're married? Cool. What's our part in marriage? Nothing, really. Just we care about marriages more than we do weddings or how it's done. So why did the church start dabbling its fingers in marriage? Well, four reasons. They might catch you by surprise: politics, incest, problems with consent, and class issues. First, politics. Everywhere in history, especially after the Protestant Reformation, you have some king or queen who's like, I want to marry that person, and I'm not allowed, so I'm going to start a new denomination that says it's okay to marry that person. So, church and politics. But then there's incest. Which, well, remember this guy, Joseph Henrich? We talked about him a few weeks ago. Author of The Weirdest People in the World, How the West Became Prosperous, all that stuff. He said that there was a very distinct movement. He's looked through Vatican archives. Found in the Middle Ages, the church really started encouraging people to not marry their cousins. A policy. Hey, maybe God doesn't want you to marry your first cousin. And this started to advance. And of course, we know today that's a good thing, because it isn't good for the gene pool if you're marrying your cousins. I don't know how much the church knew of that back then, but inbreeding puts offspring at a much higher risk of inheriting recessive genetic disorders. And so the church comes along and is like, we're cool with everybody can get married however they want, but maybe not your sister, brother, cousin. Fair? Now, the Protestants came along, and they would have to deal with this consent thing, because until the 12th century, the church held that marriage was valid if it was entered into by mutual consent and sealed by sexual intercourse. But then this one theologian came along and he cracks me up. Peter Lombard is the Bishop of Paris. And he says, ooh, that's a problematic definition, because if marriage has to be consent and sex, then Mary and Joseph weren't married. Huh. Church goes, oh, that's no good. Okay, let's just stick with consent. Stick with consent. That became the official church position. If you say, I take you to be my wife, I take you to be my husband, in the present tense, you're married. But things got complicated. And this was entirely shocking but funny to me. In medieval courts in the Middle Ages, the majority of disputes over marriage during the Middle Ages did not involve cases of divorce. The majority of cases were disagreements whether a marriage had been consented to. The most common court case found in the Middle Ages was a guy saying to the court, she said she married me. And her saying, no, I didn't. And the church and courts being like, huh. This consent thing was cool, but I don't know whose story to believe here. And so you have all these stories of some poor guy being like, that rich woman, she said, I marry you. And some woman who didn't want to be in her current marriage going, actually, before this marriage, I consented to that marriage, so I got to get out. And the church like, what do we do? I don't know whose story to believe. But ultimately, the Lombard doctrine boiled down to this. If a couple said, using the present tense, I take you as my husband or I take you as my wife, they were married, with or without witnesses, bans, blessings, or anything else, whether they said the words in a chapel, a kitchen, a field, or a barn, and whether or not they had ever had sex or taken up residence together. The church's position on marriage, you could say, for the first 1,500 years was very low. But it started to become a problem in the courts, and it became a problem for families, because remember, families, we got to consolidate our wealth, and all of a sudden you got two youngsters saying, too late, we said, yep, we said the words. So now parents and families come along, they don't like where this is heading. So the Protestant Reformation comes along, and in Zurich, in 1525, very first time, we have an ordinance that says this: a marriage is not valid unless attended by two pious, honorable, and incontestable witnesses. I'd like to know, like, I don't think you're pious enough. You don't count. You don't count. But this was the solution to consent problem. Hey, she said she married me. We need two witnesses to that. 1534, Nuremberg officials ruled that parental consent up to the age of 25 for men and 22 for a woman was needed for legal marriage. So now church is getting involved. We've got some more rules going on. And with these rules creeping in, we start to see the emergence of marriage as we know it. I mean, what do you traditionally do at a wedding, right? First thing, most important thing is I need some witnesses. I need some witnesses. And then, though it's less so today, it's still a bit of, well, when I asked Kristen to marry me, I went to her father and mother and said, will you give your blessing? Which is really meaningless. Like, will you give your blessing on our marriage? I didn't ask permission. Will you give your blessing? A bit of an empty gesture, but it's a way to, hey, for 250 years, we've been asking parents for permission, so... Okay, so now we're starting to see marriage as we know it. And I have to mention this because it cracks me up. Rules around marriage start coming up, but so do rules around divorce and separation. This was the rules for separation. Four reasons: adultery, a partner's heresy, which they called spiritual fornication, which I think is great. She committed spiritual fornication. Extreme cruelty, I don't know exactly what that means, and male impotence. That last one cracked me up so much, because to have your marriage annulled, this is for real, a man had to submit to a humiliating ordeal designed to make sure he and his wife were not colluding. So one church legal expert explained the process. The man and woman are to be placed together in one bed, and wise women are to be summoned around the bed for many nights. If the man's member is always found useless and as if dead, the couple are well able to be separated. I'm annoyed because I actually have a much more explicit detail on how a wise woman was summoned and her findings, but Kristen said you cannot say that in your sermon. So if you want to know, come talk to me after. I'll tell you about the process. It's a real doozy. That's crazy. Wise woman summoned. I wonder, how do you get the designation wise woman? I don't know, but don't want to do that. Then, of course, there's class issues because poor people are trying to marry into rich families. And so Lisa O'Connell says this, as clandestine weddings and the unruly culture that surrounded them began to threaten power and property, questions about where and how to marry became urgent matters of public debate. In 1753, in an unprecedented and controversial use of state power, Lord Chancellor Hardwicke mandated Anglican church weddings as marriage's only legal form. Resistance to his marriage act would fuel a new kind of realist marriage plot in England and help to produce political radicalism as we know it. This was unprecedented, and I can't believe this. I've studied this act before, and I found it in a painting. This is called The Election Entertainment. And what we have here is all these, you know, wealthy, everybody having a good time, but out the window are protesters, and you can't see it, but on that little flag there, they're like, God, Lord Hardwicke's marriage act, because the idea was this, how dare the church and state say to us how or where or who we marry? This was seen as the church and state way overstepping their boundaries. Who is the church and state to tell us how we can get married? And for 1,500 years, they have a point. The whole thing was, I take you, done. But along comes big, powerful people, incest, all these different factors, the church starts meddling into the affairs of marriage. And now it leads to, it birthed the way we understand marriage today. Witnesses, parental approval, blessing, and now marriage is either legalized by the state or church. So we arrive at our understanding, and in that time, you still have 250 years of history where the Industrial Revolution, technology, ease of travel and mobility, less need for extended family, all these things are contributing to the latest expression we have of marriage today. And you could say we sort of live in this hybrid model of modern marriage and whatever it's emerging into. So today we have some big changes, autonomous choice over family influence. It's interesting because autonomy is such a value of ours. We don't want people interfering. In fact, I think a year or so ago, we sent out this questionnaire to Nexus. Would you let your parents pick your marriage partner? Not surprisingly, that didn't score well. Fairly low, because we don't want people interfering in our marriages. We prize autonomous choice, and so that's come to trump any sort of family influence today. And yet, the influence is still there. A relic of the past, but it's still there. Consider this. If you're married, when you got married, who was there? Who was primarily there? Probably family. I had people at my wedding that I, like cousins that I'd never met, and I'm like, I don't even understand why they're here, taken up, well, we're paying for this. You know, oh, geez, you know, you just gotta, okay, I guess my parents get to invite their friends and family. Doesn't matter how much I want them there, but there's still that family instinct. You know, it's good to see my good friend Riley here today. Just got married back in the fall, and it was quite the occasion, but Riley was just telling me this weekend that the photos have been delayed, getting his photos back from the photographer, because I don't know how to sit in a kilt, and apparently some of the photos need editing because a little too revealing. But at his wedding, right, we go to weddings, and it's, you know, even if family doesn't get along, we still see it as, okay, everyone knows Uncle Joe is a real weirdo, but we have to invite him because it's a It's still a family affair, but even still, autonomy, autonomous choice trumps that, and we have echoes of family in the past. Then, love now today trumps economic pragmatism. Like, that's not a question we ask people. When somebody's considering marriage, we don't say to them, are you economically compatible? No, what do we say? Are you attracted to them? Do you feel love for them? Maybe it comes later down the list, but maybe you're like, do they have a job? Do they, you know? Love trumps economic pragmatism. And that is a massive shift, because for vast swaths of history, it was, hey, if her crops are next to mine, this is going to be great, because then we can farm together. Like, really practical implications. And then contraception and marriage as partnership has trumped marriage as a vessel for raising family. It's hard for us to remember we are in this significant period of time where reliable contraception is only, what, like 60 years old? That's huge. For so much of history, marriage was tied to child rearing. But today, right, we can control how many kids we have. And here's the thing. My guess is there's not a single person in this room who said, you know what, I prefer marriage back then. Let the parents decide. Let, you know, I don't think any of us want to go back there. But it's also handed us a new set of challenges. What we have now is marriage as an institution where people enter into it because they've fallen in love with one another. And the troubles and tensions and stresses of that are only beginning to appear right now. Two quotes I want to sum up here. Stephanie Kuntz: today, we generally agree on what it takes for a couple to be married well. First, they must love each other deeply and choose each other unswayed by outside pressure. From then on, each must make the partner the top priority in life, putting that relationship above any and all competing ties. A married couple, we believe, owe their highest obligations and deepest loyalties to each other and the marriage. Married couples should be best friends, sharing the most intimate feelings and secrets. They should express affection openly, but also talk candidly about problems. And of course, they should be sexually faithful to each other. This package of expectations about love, marriage, and sex, however, is extremely rare. Never before in history had societies thought that such a high set of expectations about marriage was either realistic or desirable. And then Esther Perel is a little bit more funny about it. Today, we turn to one person to provide what an entire village once did, a sense of grounding, meaning, and continuity. At the same time, we expect our committed relationships to be romantic, as well as emotionally and sexually fulfilling. Is it any wonder so many relationships crumble under the weight of it all? Our expectations of our partners have never been so high. We still want everything the traditional family was meant to provide: security, children, property, and respectability. But now, we also want our partner to love us, to desire us, to be interested in us. We want to marry our best friend, our confidant on all matters, someone to whom we should be able to tell everything. And for that matter, they should not only be a stellar co-parent, but they should also be a savvy co-decorator, a skilled sous chef, a financial whiz, a motivated jogging partner, and a devilishly funny gossip, depending on what we need that day. But why are we relying on one person to fill so many roles? This is the rub we find ourselves in today. We've never, in the history of humanity, had such high expectations of marriage partners. And when you have that and couple it with the fact that we've lost marriage as any sort of sacred vessel or a sense of enchantment, a sense of sacredness, what you have is, I think, this formula: incredibly high expectations in marriage. Add to that a low sense of marriage as enchanted or sacred. I mean, it is, after all, just sharing a bed and a bank account, which equals trouble and tension. It's a heavy load to bear today. And it doesn't feel like there's a whole lot sacred or enchanted about sharing a bed and a bank account. And when marriage has to become everything under that condition, when it lacks any kind of enchantment, it can be the location of great tension and strain. It's left us in the precarious position today. Stephanie Kuntz wraps up. She says, marriage is becoming more optional, more fragile. Once predictable link between marriage and child rearing is fraying, and relationships between men and women are undergoing rapid transformation. Past 30 years, she says, more transformation than the past 3,000. I'm going to ask the band to come close. And what I want to ask, because next week we're going to talk about marriage on a ladder. And then the week after that, Carla's going to talk about boundaries in relationships. And then the one after that, sex on a ladder. I'm always looking forward to that one. And then we're going to get into friendship and community. Woo, I can't wait. But a little homework, you could say, today. Knowing this, as we get into this relational tension, I think it's helpful for us to think through, so what are my expectations in marriage? Like, what do I expect of my partner? Because so often those expectations go unsaid and unspoken. And inadvertently, we can end up, of course, putting too much on our marriage partners or expecting too much of them. Today, the institution of marriage is under stress like it rarely has been. And yet, the long view of history reminds us the institution of marriage has always been around, but it's always been in flux. And many of the things we see things today, like, oh my goodness, polyamory, we see these things, we get a little, Stephanie Kuntz reminds us, every expression of marriage you can think of has been tried before. Everything has been tried before. It might jar us. We might think, oh, what do we do with that? It's been tried somewhere before. And yes, marriage is under pressure, but marriage, like faith, ain't going anywhere. It's been a human universal since the beginning of time. I don't expect it to disappear anytime soon, but we would do well to talk about what it means. And so, next week, marriage on a ladder. What does it mean to navigate the waters of marriage today? And what, if anything, does Scripture have to say about it?